Do you ever wonder what's happening behind the scenes of the multi-trillion dollar fashion industry? In the new podcast, Fashion People, Puck correspondent and 20-year fashion veteran Lauren Sherman and a rotating cast of industry insiders discuss what fashion people are really talking about behind the scenes of the star-studded business, from creative director switcheroos to M&A drama, DTC downfalls, and Met Gala mishaps. Fashion People, a presentation of Odyssey in partnership with Puck, is available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Like, decompress.
Hi, I'm Kimberly Adams, and welcome back to Make Me Smart, where we try to make today make sense.
We do, we do. This is one of the days when I'm pretty sure we succeed, thanks to a lot of help, because none of us is as smart as all of us. It is What Do You Want to Know Wednesday, the day of the week where we get to answer the questions that you all send us and learn along with you in the process. It is a pretty remarkable circle of life. You can send your questions, as always, to makemesmart@marketplace.org or leave us a voicemail at our new phone number, 508-827-6278, also known as 508-82-SMART.
Cherie in South Dakota emailed us after last week's Right to Repair episode, and she writes, "Your Right to Repair guest said that if everyone kept their phone one more year, it would be like taking 600,000 cars off the road. What is it about phone manufacture that is so carbon intensive?" Which leads me to my next question. One reason that I'm hesitant to buy an electric vehicle is that I'm worried the same thing will happen to my car that happened to my phone. The battery is great at first, but 4 years in, it won't hold a charge for a day, and some of the software is buggy. Teslas have been on the road a number of years now. How are they doing as they age? Is there a used market, or are they unrepairable? Can we recycle the batteries? Ooh, lots of questions there.
Yep. Lots in there. Well, and I see you put in some breaking news, basically, before we even get started about Right to Repair.
So on the Right to Repair element, the FTC voted unanimously today that they are going to take that up and start looking into regulations to make it easier for consumers and third parties to repair the stuff they own. So we don't exactly know what those regulations are going to look like yet, but the fact that it was unanimous is pretty important.
It's a big deal. Definitely. And then as to your question, let's sort of take one thing at a time. First of all, the phone thing. If you missed that episode, Kyle Weens of the repair site iFixit said, if we held on to our phones, if everybody held on to their phones just 1 year longer on average, the emissions reductions would be equivalent to taking 636,000 cars off the road. Kai and I believe gasped in unison. Because that is a big number. The number comes from U.S. PIRG, the Public Interest Research Group, which is this nonpartisan public advocacy organization. And basically, yes, 85% of the impact of making a phone is the making of the phone, the manufacturing. And it's because it takes a huge amount of raw material, 75 pounds of ore for a single iPhone 6, for example, 220 pounds of water. The report, and according to the US EPA, said that Americans throw away 416,000 phones a day. We buy, I mean, the numbers are just like staggering. We buy 161 million new smartphones a year, meaning that we need, that takes 23.7 million tons of raw material to satisfy, or the equivalent of an Empire State Building in material every 6 days. Just in America.
It's how many like old cell phones do you have in your house?
Like six. I give them away like candy. I mean, these are from the old days of CNET, right? So I've got like weird old LG curve phones that they were like, please don't send that back because it never actually went into production in the United States. But literally every time a kid comes over here and is like, I wish I had a phone, I'm like, hey, mom or dad, would your kid like this old Android phone? But yeah, and then I send the old ones to my family all the time. But yeah, like it's not a, I don't know.
I worked with Santa to facilitate recycling two of my old cell phones to some nieces and nephews nice. Last year. So, you know, that was a good collaboration.
That is a really good one. And before we get to the electric car question, which we will, I mean, some of the companies have gotten better about trade-in where they resell, like trade-in incentives really for phones, where they resell the phones or recycle them. But the truth is, like, we're all basically on some version of a subscription plan. A lot of us with phones, we just get mm-hmm. a new one every 2 years because that's when the contract is up. And that is a big issue. Now, to the question about cars.
I'm going to still leave that one to you because this is your thing.
Okay, well, funny story. I recently leased a Tesla. And
did you?
I did. And it makes me feel like a hypocrite and a drone simultaneously. I was going to write a Medium post called Tesla Culpa because of all of the comments I have made. However, I still stand by some of those comments because the car has tried to kill me more than once. But that's not the point. The point is, what I found interesting is that there's no option to buy the Tesla at the end of the lease period. And I wondered if that is related to battery life, because I had the exact same question, which is, does the battery degrade over time? And the car software does a lot to try to preserve the life of the battery. For example, by default, it only charges to 90% as opposed to 100%, unless you're going on a trip and you can manually change it. And part of that is to preserve the kind of like lifetime of the battery. They do degrade over time, of course. They are a battery, and that happens with every – even a supercar from 50 years ago will have a slower to 0 to 60 than it did 60 years ago. The batteries in electric cars are built to last longer. They're denser, and they're not supposed to degrade quite as quickly. I think these car makers are all going to have to come up with some kind of a system where they replace them. Tesla apparently already will cover a battery pack if its capacity gets down to 60 or 70%. And but there is a used car market for all of these Teslas and other EVs. And so presumably this is something that is going to have to be figured out in the future. And that's going to have to include recycling, because right now, although there is some capacity to recycle some of the rare metals inside these batteries and potentially the lithium, it's not happening at scale. Mm. And it's going to probably take both technology and policy to make that happen.
And when you say that these batteries are built to last, I, in 2005, had a new Ford Escape hybrid. And I was very mm-hmm. excited about it because there weren't a lot of hybrids back then. And that thing outlasted my time in the United States. I moved to Egypt. My cousin drove it for a while. And I think it only conked out in, I want to say, like 2018. Wow. So 13 years, that's not terrible.
No, it's definitely not. No. And I mean, you had some gas to back you up, but still, this is not going to be like a cell phone where I assume. Mm-hmm. I am assuming this is not going to be like a cell phone where 3 to 4 years in, all of a sudden your car will only charge, you know, halfway and the range is cut in half. That is just not a sellable proposition, and the battery technology is getting better. But the recycling has to follow. Like, has to follow. Yeah. Otherwise, these things are, you know, they're already greener on an only relative scale, right, than a fossil fuel-powered car. Like, they don't contribute to emissions when you're driving them, but there are certainly lots of emissions that go into creating them. And if we're just making new batteries every time, that does not fulfill the promise.
Well, and also the most environmentally friendly thing you can do is keep the car that you have as long as possible and keep it running, you know, rather than get a new one just for fun. Totally. All right, we should probably get to the next one.
Let's do it. Our next question comes from Michelle in Ohio, and she wants to know, hey, whatever happened to that whole cancel federal student loans push, or maybe the forgive $10,000 per person? It was such a huge topic back in March or so, she says, and then it went quiet. Loans are coming off their federal pandemic pause soon, and I want to know what's going to happen.
I want to know what's going to happen, too. We haven't heard a lot about it. She's, you know, Michelle's right. We haven't heard much about it lately. There have been a lot of things going on. The Biden administration didn't try to include student loan forgiveness as part of its budget plan. It's not in this big infrastructure proposal, but still not entirely off the table. There's some reporting from CNBC that the administration is waiting on like a memo or some guidance from the Department of Education as to their thoughts on the legality of whether the president can forgive student loan debt through executive action. And, you know, which student loan debt? We're probably talking about like Pell Grants and federal student loans, not necessarily the private ones, which are all kind of mess in a different way. But there has been a lot of confusion around it recently because Biden did cancel $1.5 billion in student loan debt through what's called the Borrower Defense to Repayment Program, which was basically for people who were defrauded by schools that, you know, convinced them to get federal loans for degrees that like weren't worth anything. And so it had that program had kind of gone quiet during the Trump administration. Biden came in and revived it and extended relief to nearly 92,000 borrowers. So, yeah, that some people got student loan debt relief, some stuff, but the large scale movement is on pause, it seems. Like, you know, Michelle pointed out, the sort of moratorium or the pause on student loan repayments for federal student loans, that is scheduled to end on October the 1st, but the administration is considering an extension. And I think you did an episode on this, right?
Mm-hmm. We did. So we'll have a link to that on the show notes. I would imagine, to your point, Michelle, the closer we get to October, the more we're going to start to hear about it again.
Yes, that's kind of how things work in Washington. Deadlines come up and all of a sudden people get very noisy.
Yep.
All right. Our next question comes from Dan in Los Angeles, who sent us a voice memo. Thank you, Dan.
I'm a new resident physician who completed my intern year during the pandemic. And over the last few months, I feel like I've gotten at least 20 or so emails from a hospital announcing the retirement of our physicians that we work with. My question is, how are all these physician retirements and doctors leaving the medical field early going to affect the doctor shortage in the US today? Will there be a push to produce more physicians, or will non-physician providers become more prominent?
We can tag team this one, and thanks to our producers for all this amazing research, because evidently the answer is probably both. Yeah, we're going to definitely have to produce more physicians. This is one of those times where I learned so much reading the prep for this answer. For example,
same.
Studies suggest the country could be short 130,000 doctors by 2030. That's a problem. And honestly, side note, I don't know if you tried to get a doctor's appointment lately, but like, you can't. Everybody's overworked and many have left, and it's a whole mine left during COVID, my GP, and burned out.
The trauma of what they've all been through. God bless them, you know. Can't really blame people who survived working in hospitals and working with patients through what we've just been through and what unfortunately it looks like we're about to go through again in some capacity with the Delta variant. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. And I'll add, just because this is something I happen to be looking at, we're also super short mental health practitioners, which is another giant need at the moment.
Yeah. Definitely. And what I learned in reading this, and I did not know, so thank you to Marissa and Bridget for putting this together, and maybe our intern Grace. Congress. So apparently the number of medical residency slots to train doctors is a big bottleneck. That's part of the reason that we have this ongoing doctor shortage, because there aren't enough of these medical residency openings. And the number of those slots is set by Congress, because they're federally funded positions. I had no idea. The Centers for Medicaid and Medical Services pays hospitals to hire residents. The cap, by the way, until COVID, this is astonishing, had remained unchanged since 1997.
Wild.
1997. There have been the same number of medical residency slots since 1997 until, of course, COVID happened. And the relief legislation, the package that the Biden administration passed, included funding for 1,000 more. And then there is There is legislation to increase it by another 2,000 positions. But yeah, that gets us to part two, which I'll let you handle.
Yeah, which thank you, Marissa, and all that non-physician providers, which, you know, Dan mentioned in his comment, are doing more care. They're becoming more common. And these like nurse practitioners who, to be perfectly honest, when I go to the air quote doctor, I'm going to see a nurse practitioner most of the time. And there's a push to give them more authority, so that they can do more of that sort of basic level care and then refer you to specialists or, you know, a sort of full doctor when you need one. And California decided to allow nurse practitioners last year to practice independently, so they don't necessarily have to partner with a doctor. And 28 other states already do this. And then you have places like Dollar General and I think Walmart also starting to talk about setting up their own clinics because this doctor shortage is having a major impact in rural areas. I remember there was a Washington Post story from a while back before the pandemic about a guy who was like the only doctor in like this massive part of Texas where he had to drive hours and hours to see anybody. And, you know, he was bouncing from emergency room to emergency room because there was literally no one else.
Oh, so, yeah. I don't think in this conversation we should overstate the value of telehealth services helping to fill some of those voids too. Yeah.
Well, just to sort of harken back to the previous question, this is an area where government policy can do something. You know, do you want to tie student loan forgiveness to going to work as a doctor in a rural area or training to be a doctor or have a lower cost program to try to get more doctors and nurse practitioners in the field? I don't know. Anyway.
Yep.
All right.
Definitely. All right. I think that is it for What Do You Want to Know Wednesday. I hate to shortchange our last question, but let's save it for the next time that we're hosting together. We will be back tomorrow. In the meantime, keep sending your questions, your comments, your thoughts, your voicemails, your emails, your voice memos. makemesmart@marketplace.org. That number, once again, if you want to call us because you're in the car right now, 508-827-6278. 508-82-SMART, S-M-A-R-T, S-M-A-R-T. It's a Simpsons thing, and I just can't.
Don't tight.
Well, yeah.
The Simpsons,
I was
going
to make a joke about that, but the last time I did it, I set off everybody's Google. So I'm not allowed.
Make Me Smart is produced by Marissa Cabrera, who just heroes work all that research. And today's program was engineered by Juan Carlos Torrado.
Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez composed our theme music. Our senior producer is Bridget Bodner. Yeah, there's a
we're still
classic.
Getting calls about that, what you did last time.
I mean, yes, it's very embarrassing. And also, wow. There's a Simpsons episode where Homer famously sings, "I am so smart, S-M-R-T."
Oh, no.
And it has prevented me for close to 20 years from being able to spell the word smart because I'm always like, S-M-R-T.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.